But let me say a couple things this morning. One of them, just relating to the storm, this just thought crossed my mind. I think this might be an encouraging story to tell. I was at a camp, a Bible study camp for guys in Pennsylvania, probably 4 or 5 years ago. And there was a young man there who was from Brazil, who taught us to sing Master the Tempest is Raging in Portuguese. So we'd sung it in English, we'd sung it in Portuguese, and that was in the evening right before we went to bed. So we had the lights out in the cabins and just barely got into bed when the camp director came knocking on all of our doors, calling us outside. One of the men, who was actually here Friday night, his son at Florida College had a homemade boat that he was on the offshore with when a terrible storm had come up, and they didn't know where he was, and so that was very alarming. And so we all came out together and prayed together for him, and did not know till the next morning what had happened to him. He turned out to be safe. They finally got back to shore and everything was fine. But it caused us to have a new reason to be thankful that the Lord is the God of the storm. Obviously, that song really emphasizes the idea there are a lot of other kinds of storms that the Lord protects and cares for us in, and that's helpful. But it's helpful to know also that He cares for us even in physical storms. What would we do if we didn't have the Lord to turn to and to trust in difficult situations? I also thought I would say, though I don't normally make comments about people, but there are several people here this morning came from other places that mean a lot to me. And it just reminds us of what a blessing we have in having brothers and sisters all over the place that we can share together with, that we can share our time, that we can share the word, we can share the Lord. And you just realize the Lord has just blessed us so much. There is a young man in Brazil who is in a really difficult place. Only a couple of men in the congregation. His own father has left his mother. He's 14 now, and he was able this spring. He probably not met 25 Christians in his life, never met another young man who was a Christian. He was able to come to kind of a big Bible study we had on the other end of the country, probably doubled the number of Christians he'd ever met. And I just think about so many people like that who would be blown away by being able to be in opportunities like this to worship together and to encourage each other together. We just have a wonderful blessing, and may God help us use that to reach out to others, to glorify Him, and to carry out the mission God's given us. So we're in Genesis 31. We've been talking about Jacob, how after he double-crossed his brother a couple of times, his brother was not too happy with him. He had decided that as soon as Isaac dies, he's going to kill him. Rebekah got wind of that and shuttled him off to the place where her family was from so that he could get a wife. And he did, though that was a complicated procedure. He worked 7 years for Rachel and then got double-crossed. And he ended up getting Leah instead of Rachel, her sister, and then married Rachel and had to work another 7 years to pay her off. And then made a deal with his father-in-law to work for wages. And that was a complicated mess. They were both trying to double-cross the other one. And finally, Jacob got tired of it. He'd been 20 years away from home, and he talks to his wives, and he says, it's time for us to go back. And they agree, and so they do. However, they don't tell Laban. They don't tell, his father-in-law, because they're afraid of what his reaction might be. And unbeknownst to Jacob, Genesis 31:19, Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's, and brought them along with her. I don't know what she was thinking. I don't know if she just believed in the gods and thought if she had the idols, maybe they'd protect her on the journey. Some people think that being in possession of the household gods would somehow guarantee getting the father's inheritance. I don't know. She had them, whatever. And Laban finds out they've fled, and chases them, and he's a lot more mobile than they are with the whole family and flocks and herds and so forth. So he catches up to them and says, what did you mean just leaving like this and didn't give me a chance to say goodbye or anything? And why did you steal my gods? Well, Jacob is quite indignant and, says in verse 32, the one with whom you find your God shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. So in a rather dramatic moment, you see Laban going tent by tent through the various people involved until he finally comes to the tent of Rachel, where you know he's going to find those household idols and what's going to happen. Only she claims that she's having a female issue and can't get up, and so she's sitting on these idols and he never finds them. So you've got kind of a new crime here, God napping, and makes you wonder what in the world Rachel's thinking. You see how God is protecting them even when they're not behaving very well. Laban and Jacob end up making sort of an agreement between them that they'll not mess with one another, and that Jacob will take care of his daughters and so forth. So that's chapter 31. That's really all I want to say about that. Do you have some comments and questions about that chapter? All right, I want you to look at chapter 32. There's a lot in this that I think is helpful. Chapter 32, Jacob is coming back, and he does not really know if Esau has cooled down. It's been 20 years. You'd think it'd be long enough, but, how do you know? And so he sends messengers ahead of him to say, listen, Jacob's coming, and blah, 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 and so the messengers come back to Jacob after informing Esau and says, he's coming to meet you with 400 men. Whoa. I mean, when you don't know if he's still ready to kill you and he's got a small army with him, it doesn't sound hopeful. You know, he's pretty tense about this. And, his guilty conscience probably leads him also to suspect the worst. And so he, in verse 9, he prays to God and asks in verse 11, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. And then, you know how Jacob is. Jacob's always got a plan. He's always got a scheme. Remember what his name means. He's the grabber. And he's always trying to grab things for himself. So he comes up with a plan. What do you do when somebody's really angry with you? What do you do with when your wife is really upset with you? Gifts, presents. That's what he hits upon. He'll get a gift. Maybe that'll make Esau happy with him. Now, you've given presents before. Maybe you've given presents to your wife in those situations or someone else. You ever given a present like this one? Verse 13. He selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau. 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 ewes, 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, and 10 male donkeys. Wow! That is a incredible present. He's just sort of inundating Esau with wave after wave of gifts. What does that tell you about Jacob? He's really wealthy, and he's really scared. Exactly. You wouldn't fork over all these animals if you weren't really worried about what Esau's going to do to you. I mean, he's trying to give him so many presents that he's got to be happy with him. I mean, I think that's almost the mindset here. And he micromanages every detail, including the space between the waves of gifts and all this sort of thing. You can tell he's just really insecure about this, and he's really upset. But for the first time in his life, I would suggest to you that he's not really confident of his plan. chapter 32, verse 22. Now he arose that same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Now, this is a very, I believe, important story. This man who wrestled with him until daybreak, according to Hosea, was an angel. This was the Lord wrestling with Jacob all night. I really believe that this story that we're about to look at is a key to understanding Jacob and is a very beneficial story for us to think about in our own life. I think that the man, the Lord, wrestling Jacob all night represents the fact that Jacob has been fighting against the Lord and wrestling with him his whole life. He has been trying to assert himself and in self-reliance and self-will manage his own affairs and do what he wanted to. And I think that's what we do. We wrestle the Lord trying to say, I'm going to be master of my own life, not you. And the Lord keeps wrestling us, trying to humble us and make us realize that we need him and we're dependent on him. So, verse 25, when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. So God cripples Jacob kind of supernaturally in this wrestling match to humble him. Or in the actual story of what's happening externally, Jacob has managed to outwit Esau, to outwit Isaac, to outwit Laban, but finally, he hasn't got a solution for the Esau issue. He finally realizes he can't handle this himself. God's got him where he wants him, desperate, with no resources. He sent the presents, but he doesn't think that's going to be enough. And so until this moment in Jacob's life, he's been a Jacob. He's been the grabber. He's been the guy who does things for himself. Thank you very much. Until now, God has not prevailed in the wrestling match. But God finally cripples him. That is, God finally sends Esau with 400 men to scare him to death so that he will finally realize he needs the Lord. He needs more than just his plan and his scheme. And so then he said, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. That is quite a change of behavior. Jacob has never needed God's blessing until now. He didn't think. He's always had a plan. He didn't need God for the birthright. He'll swindle it out of his brother for a pot of stew. He didn't need God for the blessing. He'll personify, put on the mask of his brother and manage to swindle it out of Isaac. He didn't need God for dealing with Laban. You know, he'll put those rods in front of the animals when they're mating. You know, that'll do the trick. But now, finally, God has humbled him to the point where he says, I won't let you go unless you bless me. Jacob understands he's wrestling with a representative of God, and he knows he needs God's blessing. He can't do this on his own. It is such a blessing for us when we're desperate. And when we finally come to realize, I can't handle this. I'm not sufficient for this. I've got my plans, but I don't think my plans are going to work. I need the Lord. And so in verse 28, he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. He said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. I believe the name change is significant. Names in the Bible are different than names for us. I don't even know what Gary means. I don't really care. I don't know what my kids' names meant. I don't really care. We name them more by the sound, by people we know with that name, whatever. You know, but for all the time in the Bible, names meant something. And when you change the name, it means something. It means what God's changing in Jacob. And I believe this name change means that he quit wrestling with God as a Jacob and started clinging to God as an Israel. That he was a prince with God. Instead of a grabber, instead of somebody who's doing it for himself, he's determined to have God's blessing and help. We are just like Jacob. We don't want to do things for ourselves. We don't want to depend on God or anybody else. You know, we like to be independent. We like to be self-sufficient and self-confident. Will God have to cripple us or scare us half to death before we trust him? It reminds me of some of the statements that Paul makes in 2 Corinthians 12, where God gave him the thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan. And he did that to keep Paul from exalting himself. Paul asked three times that God would take that thorn away from him. And God says in 2 Corinthians 12:9, "My grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness." We are the strongest when we are the weakest. Why? Because we turn to the Lord and trust in him. Our weakness, our feeling overwhelmed and inadequate, can be such a blessing to us. Because it can wean us off of our pride and self-confidence and cause us to really put our trust and faith in the Lord. He says, "Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I'm well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Self-sufficiency is a terrible handicap in serving God. It's only when we're broken that we are strong. Only when we're crippled that we're healed. So I think that God has been working on Jacob for a long time in a lot of ways. And finally, Jacob came to the breaking point where he was willing to cling to God instead of fighting against him. And when he does that, well, he meets Esau and everything's wonderful. You know, Esau's so glad to see him. And, you know, it turns out very well. Esau's not held a grudge and the 400 men aren't his posse and all that. And, but this event helped Jacob become an Israel. And we need that transformation also. That's my take on that story. So that's a lot. Comments, thoughts, questions, ideas. Yes, sir. You know, I mean, I think it's ambivalence. You know, he does acknowledge it, but he's got those rods in front of him. I mean, and he keeps, you know, engineering things. I think sometimes we can verbally say, "Oh yeah, I depend on God. I trust in God. You know, God's everything to me." I don't know that we always really live it. So I think some of that is Jacob saying the right thing, but not really living it. That's my take. Good question. Other thoughts?
Did God say, though, that it was from him about the
flock? Yeah, I think it absolutely was. I mean, Jacob didn't have anything to do with it. But I don't know that he fully internalized that until now. Other thoughts?
I think he used the same opportunity when he deceived Isaac. Isaac asked, "You know, how did you get this game so quickly?" He came up with an opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we use God language to salve our conscience, but to really trust him and rely on him and not feel like we have to do things our own way and even wrong ways to achieve what we want requires a level of trust more than just talking about God. Other thoughts? So, he ends up continuing on in the journey. Esau wants to accompany him. He doesn't want that, perhaps for several reasons. And he ends up finally coming to Shechem. I think he should have gone to Bethel and paid the vow, and he'll later be told by God to go to Bethel. But he comes to Shechem and he settles down there. And so that's chapter 33, and that's what I'm going to say about that. But chapter 34, he's got a daughter. We've seen that already, Leah's daughter, Dinah. And she went out to visit the daughters of the land. I'm assuming that probably wasn't the best place for her. When Shechem, the son of Hamor, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. You know, here's the case of seeing and taking what doesn't belong to him. He was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her. So he forces her, but then he seems to really want her. Sometimes people force them and then hate them, discard them, like Amnon did with Tamar, but that's not the case here. And Shechem talked to his father and said, "Can you get her for me?" Well, so that's what's going on there. Dinah is apparently with Shechem and Hamor. Hamor is going to try to see if he can get an intermarriage deal to where Shechem, his son, can have the woman he loves, Tamar, Jacob, and Leah's daughter. Verse 5, Jacob heard that he defiled Dinah, his daughter, and his sons were with the livestock in the field. So Jacob kept silent until they came in, and he doesn't seem to do anything about it. I mean, if you're the father, would you just be passive about your daughter being violated? Wonder why Jacob's so passive. I have an idea. Who's Dinah? Leah's daughter. I don't think he'd have done that with Joseph or with Benjamin. Or somebody he really was attached to, and she's just Leah's daughter. So he just doesn't seem to be that concerned. You think about the overprotectiveness he had, especially with Benjamin. And even with Joseph. He didn't seem to have that with Leah. You know, and so the sons of Jacob come in, and they're angry. And they're infuriated. And they're indignant. And so they work out this deal where Jacob's sons say, "Oh yeah, we'll work out an intermarriage agreement, but we are circumcised. And so we couldn't intermarry with you guys unless you guys are all circumcised." Now, who gave the covenant of circumcision to the Israelites? God. So they are using God's holy circumcision as a tool to further their wicked plans. This is a pretty despicable thing to do. They get the Shechemites to all circumcise themselves. That's not a pleasant operation for adults. And they're saying that way you'll be like us and we can intermarry, and that way Shechem can have Dinah. But what they're going to do is they're going to pounce on them and slaughter them when they're in their pain of the circumcision. And of course, there may be some also thought of kind of retribution for what Shechem did to Dinah with the circumcision. And so they go in and slaughter the Shechemites. Now you might think, well, they're just so upset about what, you know, Shechem did to Dinah. Well, maybe they were, but I noticed that in verse 27, after they killed the Shechemites, they came and loot the city and take their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field, and they captured and looted all the wealth. You know, if they're really so purely trying to execute justice, which probably wasn't their job anyway, why are they looting and getting all this stuff and so forth? It looks to me like they have even mixed motives, and they're using this as an opportunity to enrich themselves. And so Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, verse 30, "You brought trouble on me by making me odious," that means making me stink, "among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men being few in number. They will gather together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister as a harlot?" I don't know, what do you think about Jacob's rebuke? What's he basically saying? You shouldn't have done this because... Yeah, there's more of them than there is of us. We're going to be in trouble. You know, we're kind of foreigners in this foreign land. You really made a problem for me. Do you think that was the best rebuke for him to have given? What should he have said? This is wrong. You know, sometimes we rebuke things that makes it not work. It's not going to work well. When really we ought to say, no, this is not right. He's more self-focused than this. You've made a problem for me. Well, that's not really the issue. They've really done what was wrong before the Lord. They abused circumcision, used as a tool to execute vengeance and to take the spoil from the people of Shechem. So, and they're like, well, should he treat our sister as a harlot? This is a very unsatisfying exchange, it seems to me, and shows some bad attitudes all around in this. Thoughts and comments on chapter 34. Carrie. Right.
And it cost them, cost everybody, because of one man's desire and one woman's decision to do something probably that would turn out to.
Yeah, lots of illustrations of that in the Bible. You know, one sin leads to the next, one poor choice creates a ripple effect, a domino effect. So we need to be careful, and we see the consequences of going out to be with the people of the land, for example, in this case. Jeremy. Agreed. Yeah, I would agree with that. Other thoughts, questions, comments? Okay, so chapter 35, God says, arise, go up to Bethel and make an altar there to God who appeared to you when you fled from your brother Jacob. I think they should have done that already. And then this is disconcerting, verse 2, Jacob says to his household, put away the foreign gods which are among you, and purify yourself and change your garments. We're going to go out to meet the Lord, you better get rid of your gods. You know, it's kind of like having, you know, one of the elders over and, well, you know, we need to, you know, get rid of the beer or something like that, I don't know. You know, it's like, whoa, they had these, Jacob knows and they've got these gods and, you know, so they hide them under the oak. In verse 4, almost makes you wonder if they're not going to go back there and get them back out after they met the Lord in Bethel. There's just some things about this whole family that are disappointing. They do go to Bethel. God protects them as they go there. Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, dies in verse 8. God appears to Jacob and encourages him. You know, he tells him that he's going to be bless him, just like he's promised Isaac and Abraham. He renews that promise to Jacob. And then, verse 16, Rachel is about to give birth. Remember, she has one son already. Who's that? Joseph. Now she's about to give birth. She's suffering severe labor. The midwife says in verse 17, do not fear, for now you have another son. She's dying. She names him son of my sorrow, Benoni. But his father realizes that's probably not the best name for the poor boy and names him Benjamin, son of my right hand. And Rachel dies. Can you imagine what impact that had on Jacob? Rachel's gone. I mean, that was the love of his life. He worked 14 years for that woman when it's all said and done. And really loved her. So what does he have left to remember her by? Joseph and Benjamin. I mean, and so you understand that his preference for Rachel is going to translate into favoritism for her sons. Jacob and Benjamin are going to be his special sons. And it's one of those things that is so common in life. Here's a son gained, a wife lost. You know, we see there's one joy and there's another grief. You know, there's almost offsetting things in life all the time. You know, no joy is ever total joy. There's always a grief to accompany it. And certainly that's the case here. So Rachel's buried. And then they journey on. Verse 22, this is important for later on in the story. Reuben sleeps with Jacob's concubine. I don't know if this is a matter of lust. There are times when the wives of a former king would become the property of his successor. Is he somehow trying to seek power by doing this? He ends up losing out. Whatever his motivation was, this was not appropriate. And Reuben, who's the firstborn, will not have firstborn status primarily because of this. You can see that in several passages later on. In fact, we've now seen real defects in the three oldest children. Reuben here, Simeon and Levi were the leaders of the slaughter of the Shechemites. They're 2 and 3. And that helps you explain, who would you think of as the most important son of Jacob? Maybe Joseph to Jacob, but later on in history, who will become the most important son? Judah. What number was Judah? 4. Because Reuben's kind of set aside because of this incident, and Simeon and Levi because of the incident in chapter 34. So that really comes down to Judah as being the one who's going to be selected as more the leader of the family. And that's certainly the way it turns out as we go on. Finally, at the end of this chapter, we have the third death after Deborah, the nurse, and Rachel. Isaac himself dies. So he's lived way longer than it looked like he was going to, well over 20 years more than he had back when he gave the blessing to Jacob. He lives 180 years, he dies, and Esau and Jacob come together to bury him. Remember how Isaac and Ishmael came together to bury Abraham. That's almost a theme in Genesis. All right, thoughts and comments on chapter 35.
Mm-hmm. Because I think he dies just a very couple years before Jacob goes to Joseph in Egypt. When you get that timeline, he lives until just a
okay.
few years before.
Okay. I hadn't picked up on that. That may very well be, though. I just hadn't worked on that, so thank you. Carrie.
You talked about the names. I mean, when Leah Nature first is from...
Yeah. Right.
And you never see that in Rachel, how her feelings for Jacob weren't acknowledged at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting thought. Yeah. You know, they always name them something related to what they're thinking at the time. So that may tell you something about what Rachel's mindset is. Yes. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's true. Leah was buried in the family grave and Rachel alongside the road, perhaps. I mean, I've wondered if he didn't have other options. Maybe he was far away from the cave. I don't know how it would have been taking her body that far. Maybe this was where he could do it, but I don't know. Yeah. There's a lot of, you know, some of those things, you can read them in different ways. You can see different thoughts. Sometimes it's hard to know for sure which perspective is correct.
He's still 80 or 90 miles from what I can gather from Hebron.
Right, so it'd be a long ways
for
the whole family. Right.
So it's a slow, long haul.
Right.
That's my best guess of why she was buried there.
Yeah, that would be my take, but yeah. Gary.
I just one more thing. When Rachel named her boys Joseph and
Me, yeah. And in a way, Leah's children reflect some of that as well. I mean, even though they may be about God, they're still how she's feeling about her own situation. There may be some ways in which both women are thinking about themselves, as almost everybody ends up doing. Yes, Dave. Yes. So, God renames Jacob Israel, but he kind of reverts back to Jacob-like tendencies from time to time. Even though God's changed him, I don't know that he's totally integrated that into his life in every situation. So I think the interchange back and forth between Jacob and Israel may be a reflection of the fact there's a lot of Jacob still in Israel. Good thought. Other comments or thoughts? Yes. Tell the story twice. Oh, then he mentions it again in verse 10, 35, 10. I mean, maybe it's a call for him to be an Israel more than a Jacob. Yeah. Okay, other thoughts? Good questions, good discussion. So, chapter 36, the records of the generations of Esau. Great chapter to memorize, I'm sure. I don't have a whole lot to say about this, other than this is following our pattern when he wants to carry down the lineages. We start with the off lines, and then we come to the line he's going to carry out. So he tells about the descendants from Esau in chapter 36, and then he'll come to 37:2. These are the records of the generations of Jacob, and we'll carry it out from the descendants of Jacob. So he'll always in Genesis kind of give the off line, the part that he's not going to follow, and then he'll come back to what he's going to follow on, and we just carry on with that. So chapter 37:2 are going to be the ones that Jacob generates. So the focus is really primarily on Joseph. Thoughts or comments about 36? Okay. So 37, we have this incident, this situation with Joseph. Joseph 17. He is number 11 out of the 12. And his brothers hate his guts for three reasons that we know about. What are the three reasons? Yes, he's his father's little pet. You know, and the thing that Jacob did that just was the irritating thing to them was that coat he gave him. That special coat that he wears as a badge of distinction, and every time he wears it, he shows everybody that he's his daddy's little favorite. Now, Jacob had been a victim of parental favoritism, but he still does the same thing in his family. He didn't learn. And so, you know, I really think most of the time when parents have favorites, that it's worse on the favored one than it is on the ones that are not favored. Wow. Favoring your kid will create a lot of reaction against him from the other children and just isn't a good situation. So, I mean, really see a lot of evil done by this. What are the other two reasons why they hate Joseph?
His dream.
Yes, absolutely. Those dreams that he told about that do. It's like, you know, you think that we and your father are going to bow down to you. You know, what kind of a, you know, rascal, you know, invents a dream like that? You know, you think we're really going to do that? And so that makes them mad. Although we understand the dreams came from God and they're actually going to come true. What was the third thing that bugged them about Joseph? Yeah, he tattled on him. In verse 2, you know, when Joseph was 17 and was pasturing the flock with his brothers, you know, Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. I don't know if we ought to think of him as a tattletale, or maybe he was just concerned enough about his father that he told the thing that needed to be told. We're not really told if this was a bad thing for Joseph or not, but it certainly irritated them. So they've got all sorts of accumulated reasons to develop this hatred and loathing of Joseph, and it's just been brewing in them. Resentment and bitterness will just grow and fester, and people do horrible things because they don't deal with that. And that's certainly the way, you know, Joseph's brothers are. I mean, they're just, they can't stand him. Thoughts and comments down to 37:14. All right, we're going to pause here. And this afternoon at 3 o'clock, we'll pick back up and really try to work on telling the story of Joseph primarily, which is an amazing story. I think there's probably no story that's more fun to tell in the Bible than the story of Joseph. Just a lot of really cool things in that. So that'll be our goal. I think now we'll have a few minutes to prepare for worship.